welcome to EI Talks, the podcast that takes ideas seriously. I'm Paul Lay, Senior Editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and I'm joined by Alistair Benn, Deputy Editor at EI. Today our guest is Daniela Richterova, Senior Lecturer in Intelligence Studies at the Department of War Studies at King's College London, who is here to guide us through a remarkable aspect of the Cold War, the history of the Soviet bloc's engagements with Africa. Welcome, Daniela.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we're looking here, talking about MSI, military, security and intelligence dealings between the Soviet bloc and Africa during the Cold War, of course. Now, I want to get to the very origins of this, the source of it. How do we know what we know about those engagements?
Well, that's a great question. Thank you very much for that. Until recently, we didn't know very much about any of this, and that was because ministries of defense, intelligence agencies are famously quite cagey about sharing their documents with the public for reasons that are mostly quite understandable. But after the fall of communism in Central Eastern Europe, we actually managed to get access into Cold War intelligence, military security archives, the kind of access that we actually don't have anywhere else or in most places in the world. Definitely don't have that kind of access in the UK, in the US, in France. So as me and a number of other colleagues started looking into this issue, we found that there's actually extensive minutes of meetings between various ministries who were running security, military and intelligence assistance to Africa as well as other parts of the world. There's minutes of meetings with a lot of these African leaders, be they leaders of states or national liberation movement. There's also more specific documents, such as syllabuses of various modules that were run for these African states, be they in sharpshooting or in learning how to operate RPGs, tanks, or how to pilot Soviet bloc planes. So there's fascinating material. Where is it? It's in a number of Central Eastern European states. I work mostly with Czechoslovak archives, and there's archives of the military history archives, but also intelligence archives, Communist Party archives available there. Similar type of documents are also available in Germany, in Bulgaria, in Poland. Famously not in Russia. Russia, as you can imagine, isn't very open about its past or current dealings with Africa. There are some documents in Moscow that some of my colleagues who work specifically on Russian engagement in the Global South have worked with, and these are mostly documents of the Communist Party, which was, of course, responsible for approving a lot of this aid and for deciding where that aid went and where that support went.
And the Czechoslovak aspect is important in your work because they were particularly prominent in these activities.
Yeah, absolutely. So Czechoslovakia, you could say, was Moscow's right hand or kind of principal junior partner when it came to arms sales and military security and intelligence training. Now, why is this? Basically, Prague during the 20th century was one of the most prolific arms exporters in the world. And actually, between the two wars, Czechoslovakia, I think, was responsible for close to a fourth of world exports of arms. So it's a tiny country, or was a tiny country. It's dead now. But it really was at the forefront of arms production and sales in the 20th century.
Famously, the Bren gun, for example.
Exactly. Yes. So it also produced certain products that then became famous. And actually today, there's still some of them are quite famous. Yeah.
So what is the model that we're talking about here, this Soviet bloc model? Give us a sense of the way in which they engaged with Africa. Specifically, I suppose, what was their main focus in Africa, or what were their main focuses in Africa? And how, I suppose, did it differentiate, if we can say this, between the Soviet Union's engagement with Africa and that of the West?
Mm-hmm. So basically, the Soviet Union and Moscow becomes really actively interested in the global south and in Africa in the mid-50s. So this is during the Khrushchev era when he calls for a more activist Soviet bloc policy towards these countries and seeks to set up basically two types of alliances: overt alliances, which are characterized by political support for African leaders, economic aid, economic investment, but also various cultural programs. But there's a second element to it, and that's what I call a covert element. So basically, it's this military, security, and intelligence support. And so basically, from the mid-50s onwards, you see a lot of diplomats, spies, soldiers from the Soviet Union either come to Africa to train troops there or and obviously provide them with weapons and advice, but you also see African officers come to the Soviet bloc and to Moscow. And I think the main motivations, there's a couple of them, actually. Why does the Soviet Union decide to do this? So I think that the first reason is that they wanted to show to the rest of the world that they were a major power and that they could have presence on key, continents. The second thing was basically to keep the West kind of down and out. So this is happening as Soviet engagement is coming in as the colonial powers are being kicked out, basically. So there is this vacuum, which Khrushchev, but also other countries of the Soviet bloc want to use.
So it's in the wake of decolonization.
Exactly. So they're coming with kind of seemingly with open arms and their hands are full of cash and aid and guns. So this is kind of their way in. And it's also not just to keep the West out, but also China out, because China is looking to support a lot of these countries, but especially the national liberation movements, the more radical ones. China's coming in there as well. But, you know, the Soviet bloc also wants to make money off of this. So they also want to make especially, foreign currency gains, because they famously never have enough foreign currency and they needed to buy stuff from abroad. So it's a mixture of motives there.
What's the kind of cultural perception of the Soviets on the African side? And was there a sense that the Czechs were distinctive, or that particular countries within the Soviet bloc played particular roles in that effort?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a really interesting question, because actually the Czechoslovaks, I mean, I found some documents with my colleagues, Mikuláš Pešta and Natalia Telepneva, who I wrote a couple of things with. We found notes describing how some of the African leaders were more excited about working with smaller countries and with getting support from smaller countries such as Czechoslovakia, because they were worried about, again, aligning with a major power that could really, dominate that partnership. Also, as the regime in Czechoslovakia started being more liberal in the 60s, that was quite appealing to these countries, because, there was a lot of the ambiance there was about freedom and about sovereignty, and those were some, some glimmerings of that were present in the Prague Spring. So that actually did excite some of these African states and made them more, positive about working with the Czechoslovaks.
And what's the dynamic there between the African state or the National Liberation Movement, between the, we might call, the subsidiary powers of the Soviet bloc and the Soviet Union? How did that play itself out? Is that a test case, or is it an example of any kind of the way those tensions play out?
Tensions between the Soviet bloc states?
All three, or? I suppose. Yeah.
Well, this is the kind of dirty little secret that I think is not talked about very often, is that for 40 years, the Soviet bloc ran various military, security, and intelligence assistance programs with African states, with national liberation movements, and with states all over the world. But these did not always work according to the plan. There was actually quite a lot of friction. There was sometimes friction between the Soviet bloc states, who provides what at what time, for what price. Sometimes the Czechoslovaks are upset that the Germans are selling something for a lot cheaper price, and that's putting them out of business. Other times, they're upset with the Soviets that they are actually taking on some of the more capable cadets or the cadets training, the kind of top tier cadets, and that the lower tier cadets are being sent to Czechoslovakia. But there's also friction. And I think this is best exemplified when we look at the training programs that are run in Europe between the African cadets and the host countries. So, for instance, Czechoslovakia set up a military installation in a place called Zastavka u Brna. It's in the Czech Republic now. And there they created a special top secret facility where they were training various representatives of national security of national liberation movements and various African states. Now, the problem was that they never knew exactly how many people were going to come from overseas. They never knew whether this was going to be a homogeneous group, but usually it wasn't. Some men, and they were mostly men, would have already, you know, been in combat, so they would have some combat experience. Others were librarians who were working for the ANC's, you know, library, but wanted to go into combat. Some were literate. Others weren't literate. Some really wanted to be there. Others thought it was a bit of a holiday and just wanted some time off from, you know, fighting in these really intense environment. So actually, when these guys came over, the Czechoslovak officers, and we also know that this happened in other parts of the Soviet Union, also some of the Russian officers, were really struggling to deliver a you know, top-tier education for these Global South officers, because they didn't quite know how to work with these groups.
And which African nations became the principal focus of these engagements with the Soviet bloc? Where are the kind of flashpoints? Where are the places that are deeply affected by this?
Yeah, so, you know, there were dozens of countries that the Soviet bloc really really engaged with, and where they used military security and intelligence assistance as kind of a gateway to the to these environments, to these states. But the first big deal and the kind of groundbreaking deal was in the mid-50s, in 1955, with Cairo, Egypt. This is under Nasser. And Nasser at this time was kind of shopping around for military assistance because he was in a difficult predicament. There was increased hostilities between Egypt and Israel, who did not have a peace at the time. And so ultimately in 1955, he turned to the Soviet Union and to Czechoslovakia. And Czechoslovakia actually delivered an unprecedented amount of planes, of tanks, all sorts of boats, vehicles, cannons, and other kind of weaponry, which I think amounted to approximately $50 million. So this was a massive deal and a massive boost for basically Egyptian military security and intelligence capability. So this was a key deal. And basically in the 50s, or in the latter part of the 50s, Czechoslovakia and the USSR were responsible for 85% of Egypt's military imports. So at that point in time, it was Egypt. But what's also quite interesting is that these alliances change. This wasn't the case later on during the Cold War. But later on during the Cold War, for instance, the Soviet bloc was providing assistance to Gaddafi's regime in Libya, which from the documents we can tell was quite fun because, and actually they quite liked Gaddafi because Gaddafi used to pay in cash, which wasn't always the case. So this was great for the Czechoslovak and other Soviet bloc state arms dealers who were always just looking to get, as you know, this money quite quickly and to get foreign currency. There were some leaders who did not always pay for this military security and intelligence assistance. The first one that comes to mind is Hafez Assad, so the father of the current leader of Syria. He did not always pay for this equipment, and it was he did receive tanks and some other support in the run-up to the Yom Kippur War. And there is a very awkward conversation that the Czechoslovak Ministry of Defense and a bunch of other institutions in the country have after the war, and they say, you know, we're pretty sure we told him we want him to pay for this, but he thinks it was a gift. So this security assistance could, you know, at times was quite precarious. Deals were sometimes broken. Alliances were sometimes broken. Some of them lasted for decades. Some of them lasted for 2-3 years because some countries realized, you know what, actually, I don't want to do business with these people. The West, maybe the French, the Americans, or some other countries are offering us a slightly better deal.
And what sort of hurdles does the Soviet bloc phase here when it becomes it has these engagements with countries like Egypt, Libya, I suppose later Angola. There's issues in South Africa. There's obviously this aspect which is fundamental to intelligence, which is secrecy and security. But how does an economy like that of those of the Soviet bloc, how does it deal with things like demand, for example, quality, because it's in this battle with the West? How does it maintain what are the problems it has, and does it manage to do this?
Yeah, there's problems throughout. So if you want to become a state arms dealer or, you know, someone who does military security or intelligence assistance, you really have to brace yourself for running into a lot of hurdles. First of all, with the West, there was constant competition with regards to this kind of support with the West. At some point, the Czechoslovaks were lamenting that the West actually can provide a lot of the stuff that they're providing cheaper, and that they are providing it cheaper. Sometimes the stocks of weapons that the Czechoslovaks had were really out of date. And actually, we know that in the 50s and the 60s, they were often trying to actually sell, or when they were donating weapons, they were donating stuff from World War II. So this wasn't your, a state of the arm new technology. They were actually trying to get rid of some of their old stocks. And the people who, you know, the countries and the national liberation movements who received these weapons, they knew that they weren't, top notch weaponry, and there was often friction about that.
And that's not entirely dissimilar to what the West is doing with Ukraine, for example.
Could be. You could make that argument. But also, I talked to kind of off the record with some Central European diplomats, and they say, you know, even some of the military assistance we were providing in the 90s or in the 2000s, we weren't giving them state-of-the-art weaponry, but we were actually giving them the Soviet era and the Cold War era stuff. So that's where a part of that friction is from. But also, you're absolutely right. There's issues with capacity as well. For instance, when Khrushchev makes this call and for a more activist policy towards the global South in Africa, who has to answer this call are the people who are running these training facilities in the Soviet bloc, because they know, you know, where Soviet weapons and planes and RPGs go. That's where you need to deliver training. You need to learn these officers how to operate this equipment. And there wasn't space really to do that in Africa, not on a larger scale. So they had to build these facilities back in various parts of the Soviet Union or in various regions of Czechoslovakia. And that took time, that took a lot of effort, and they weren't actually able to keep up with the demand in the late 50s, early 60s. It was only a little bit later that they kind of caught up and took a deep breath. And actually, funnily enough, in the mid-60s, when they've got everything set up, they've got manuals, now they even got syllabuses in various languages, which wasn't the case in the beginning. Their rooms are heated. Their cadets have a place to sleep. You know, there's everything's kind of in place. That's where actually the demand drops in the mid 60s. And there's, you know, various hypotheses why that happened. Some of the African countries ran out of cash. There was this competition with the West. The West kind of caught up with what the Soviets or the Soviet bloc was doing and started providing services and quality of services that maybe wasn't available in the Soviet bloc. So it's a constant struggle between, just like you're saying, demand and the ability to provide adequate and kind of also quick support for what each nation needs.
And we know with hindsight what happens. You know, hindsight, the enemy of the historian. But we know with hindsight what happens to the Soviet bloc and the Soviet Union. But were there notable successes that it had with this engagement with Africa?
Well, I'd say that one of the big successes, I mean, you could look at the long-term and short-term success. So you could say that a number of countries, thanks to Soviet engagement, really managed to either, hold off certain insurgencies or manage to really challenge their regional rivals. I think we especially see it with some of the national liberation movements. For instance, there is a national liberation movement in Guinea-Bissau led by someone called Cabral, very famous figure. Movement benefited from over a decade-long support of the Soviet Union, but also of the Czechoslovaks, and arguably this was fundamental to them then, managing to push the Portuguese out. And there's a fascinating book, I have to plug this, of one of my colleagues, Natalia Telepneva, Cold War Liberation, who writes exactly about this, about how Soviet support was really pivotal when it came to the gradual fall of the Portuguese Empire in Africa. But I think the long-term impact is also quite interesting, because the Soviets aren't just sending, you know, guns and RPGs to Africa. They're also, part of this is a cultural offensive. So they are, I think over the course of the 40 years of the Cold War, about 60,000 African students go and study to the Soviet Union. They set up a very famous university called the Patrice Lumumba University, where many key leaders and sometimes dodgy people like Carlos the Jackal end up studying and doing their university degrees. But this is really important, because you don't have established university education in many of these countries. So it is about also winning not just that cash and political support, but exactly hearts and minds. Although there's issues there as well. I mean, Central Eastern European countries and the Soviet Union, I guess at the time, are not the most cosmopolitan and liberal countries in the world. So there's actually quite interesting work about racist incidents that happened at the time when these newly allied countries from around the world started sending their cadets or civilian students over to the Soviet bloc.
This is evidence from a rather unconventional source, but I once encountered a taxi driver who was Algerian, and we were talking about, as you do in the taxis, about the state of the world, and the Ukraine war came up, and he launched into a vitriolic rant about the West had manipulated Ukraine into war, and I sort of asked, you know, where does your affection for Russia come from? And he said, well, the Soviets were great engineers and they came to Algeria and they did loads of stuff for us, you know, infrastructure, engineering. There's this romantic perception that Moscow was on Algeria's side. Whether the support really did much for Algeria's development, I don't know. But the perception he had was very romanticised about Moscow's relationship with the developing world.
I once met a cab driver who told me the same thing. Yeah. He wasn't Algerian. I think he was Egyptian.
We got 2 points.
Exactly. So I think this counts as evidence now. I think it's actually been quite interesting being someone who was born in Czechoslovakia. When you go around the world and when you tell people you're from Czechoslovakia, in places like Egypt or Syria or other countries that were allied with the Soviet bloc during the Cold War, they give you this extra look and they sometimes know a Czech word or two. So, you know, those ties in some way really left an impact, a cultural impact, and have impacted the memory of people. When it comes to Algeria, I mean, the National Liberation Movement there, the FLN, was heavily supported by the Soviet bloc, also I think by the Chinese. And then when they took over power, I know that at that time the Czechoslovaks were providing quite a lot of aid, kind of free of charge. And there were debates about this back in Czechoslovakia about whether this is really feasible, whether they really should be doing this for free, and, you know, how do you compensate for this? But it was seen as a long-term investment, and it was seen as a country where they really started with supporting the National Liberation Movement, and they were going to stick with them as they took over power. So I guess if he grew up, your taxi driver at around that time, or his father was around that time, I mean, this must have been quite an extraordinary turn of events. And I can imagine, and I think we all know, that when the Russians, Soviets or Czechoslovaks did anything anywhere, provided support anywhere, provided assistance, that it was to be known. So there would have been meetings, there would have been posters, there would have been, it would have been known that this support came from the Soviet bloc. I was recently in Egypt and went to the Aswan Dam, where there is this majestic memorial basically dedicated to the Soviets who helped, finance and build that project. And that is in your face and it's there, you know, many, many decades later. So I think that that presence is, or that that legacy is in many ways fed by a lot of these infrastructure projects or the legacies of the Cold War.
And you mentioned earlier the Cold War rivalry between the Soviets and China. And I don't want to overdo the parallels, but it looks like something similar is happening there. We know about China's investment and involvement in Africa, which has been very explicit, which has been on an enormous scale. How does that rivalry still exist? And how is it characterized, if it does exist, in this Putin era, any rivalry between China and Russia, and indeed with the West there? How is Africa being contested now?
That's a really good question. How much time do we have? Well, you know, I'm not a China expert or Chinese foreign policy expert, but as far as I understand it, I mean, China obviously had presence in Africa and supported mostly national liberation movements during the Cold War. But what they're doing now is unprecedented. It's off the charts. Yes. I mean, it's obviously part of the Belt and Road Initiative, and it's these are massive investment projects that will have very long and long-term impact on these countries and their industries and their futures. So I think it's almost incomparable, the extent of Chinese in involvement during the Cold War now. But in the archives you can find all sorts of things. You can find manuals, sabotage manuals that were taught by the Chinese to various national liberation movements around the world. So they definitely did make a mark and did seek to make a mark. And sometimes they supported some of the movements that were seen as too radical by the Soviets, for instance. So you could say that their mark on engagement in Africa was that they perhaps supported some of the more fringe groups and gave support that the Soviet bloc wouldn't always give to these fringe groups, as in, sabotage and kind of building their paramilitary activity. When it comes to today, I mean, it's a very complex issue because there's a lot of players in the field. But maybe what I'll say is I might start with just Russia and Russian engagement in Africa, say after the Cold War. I feel that mostly when we read news reports, it sounds like Putin woke up 5 years ago and realized that Africa is important. But if you read some of the academic literature on this, you'll see that yes, the 90s there was a drop, and Russia was busy doing other things and making sure it kind of survives the fall of the Soviet Union. But towards the end of the 90s and early 2000s, there is a resurgence of contacts and engagements with Africa. And this really accelerates, I'd say, in the mid-2000s, when you have the various color revolutions in Ukraine and in Georgia, and then you have the war in Iraq. So you kind of see these first big rifts between Russia and between the West, and that really accelerates Russian policy towards other parts of the world. And then 10 years later, basically, or less than a decade later, you have Crimea. And basically, by that time, we know that the U.S.-Russia dialogue is dead. Russia knows it. The U.S. knows it. We know it. And so Russia is increasingly turning to Africa here, and that's where it's accelerating. Basically, a kind of a two-track approach. So one track is the one that really reminds us of the Cold War, right? It's the state-to-state stuff. So there's state investment deals. There's you know, also some cultural exchange. There's aid being given to various countries in Africa. But in 2017-18, we see a resurgence of kind of the second track, and that's the private military companies or proxies that are being brought in.
And this would be the Wagner Group.
Exactly. So what we used to refer to as the Wagner Group or the Wagner Network, and I think now they've rebranded to Africa Corps, which is another kind of throwback to the Hitler era. Yeah,
which has a certain historical resonance.
Basically, by 2017-2018, we've got the state-to-state dialogue and support and that track. And then we have this track that is done through private proxy companies. And it seems like it's going, if we can say, quite well for Wagner, you know, in the late 2010s, I guess. They first create a stronghold in the Central African Republic, then later in Sudan, and later they ally themselves with, you know, some of the forces in Libya. So they're kind of expanding and beyond maybe the original scope of Russia's engagement there. But then comes that I'd say deadly summer of 2023 when the Wagner Group, mostly I would argue based on how the Ukrainian war was going and the impact that was having on Wagner, but also on wider things, decide to stage a mutiny. And I think Putin gave them exactly 2 months to enjoy the rest of their lives. And in August, Prigozhin, who was the main Wagner leader, and his second man Utkin die in an untimely death in a plane crash. But it doesn't seem like that really killed off Wagner engagement in Africa. I mean, we'll still have to see what the long-term impact of that is. It's obviously Wagner was renamed, there was a tour by some of these new representatives of Africa Corps going to a number of the countries where Wagner was engaged for years to, I guess, kind of reassure them that everything's going to go the way it was planned.
This is something I thought about a few months ago. Is there a sense for the, I imagine, mostly young men involved in these operations, Russian young men? There's a kind of brutal swagger about it, a chance to go to far-flung corners of the world, you know, commit acts of violence in the name of whatever, security, guns, diamonds, minerals, be part of what is sold to them as a kind of larger project Russian power. I just always think, I haven't read enough about how these people conceptualize what they're doing, or if they do at all, but is there a kind of romance, in a way, a kind of horrible romance, an awful romance that will outlive Prigozhin? And he was quite adept at talking about that, you know, doing videos from the deserts, or doing videos which showed him in sort of Bond villain-like situations.
Or Bond hero, you know, yeah. For some, perhaps. Yeah, I think those videos really did a lot at some point for promoting the Wagner cause. I mean, you know, he at some point said, you know, you can't, if you've got a counterterrorism issue, Wagner will solve it for you. We're here to help you out. And there is a number of countries in Africa who are obviously fighting insurgencies, such as the Central African Republic. And that was the main draw why Wagner was invited there or why the Russians were invited there and then sent some of the Wagner Group people there. I don't know how whether kind of romantic ideals lead these Russian men to join Wagner. I've seen and read some interviews with former Wagner fighters, and to me it seemed like the motivation was largely economical. You know, cash. They get cash and they get paid a number of times more than they would in regular military, and many of them don't really know what they're going into. There was a fascinating interview with someone about 5 years ago who talked about the campaign in Syria, where famously the Wagner fighters or the mercenaries joined the Syrian military to fight ISIS. And this man, who was quite young, was saying, you know, we were not ready to fight people who were running towards us with machetes, and we were the first in line. So I think it's a way to lure these men into Wagner ranks is to really provide them a safe or relatively safe, I guess, income, higher than they would get anywhere else, and maybe try to appeal to their patriotism. But frankly, I don't know how that works these days. I can imagine that it worked before the war quite a bit. Now with Wagner being all over the news, I feel like some people might have been discouraged.
And in this China-Russia rivalry, if we can talk it that now, the tables seem to have been turned. China is much the bigger player, so far as I understand, in terms of its economic power, in terms of its reach, in terms of its investment. How much is Russia a rival or a disruptor?
Russia is not as major of a player in the economic sense as China is in Africa. They are responsible for about 40-45% of arms import to Africa. So they still have that edge there when it comes to military assistance. But when it comes to investment and all that stuff, I don't think they can compete.
And would you describe what China is doing in Africa? Belt and Road Scheme, everything else that's there, and what Russia is doing there. Would you call it imperialism?
I don't like using these kind of words, but it's definitely been called that. It has been called that. And it's quite interesting that actually Putin, at a big summit he held last year in the summer with African representatives, he said that Russia is fighting imperialism and Russia is fighting anti-colonialism. And this is how he's trying to basically box Russian engagement in Africa. But Russian involvement across the continent and maybe also in other parts of the world has been described by many as imperialism or neocolonialism even.
So there might be Putin doublespeak there.
There could be. Who would have thought?
Well, that's been a fascinating survey, Daniela. Thank you so much. I was particularly interested in that Czechoslovak aspect. Anyone who's read John le Carré's Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy will understand the reach of the Czechoslovak services during the Cold War. And it's fascinating to see, giving us that guide to their engagement with Africa and the way in which those battles, those engagements still continue in that post-Soviet world. So thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation.